Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Caleb Colton no longer belongs to our world.
We give him a week to see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
He belongs to theirs.
I don't want to kill.
He makes you kill tonight.
And they all belong to the night.
It's 3 hours short for a bus to get home. You help me out?
What are you on?
Believe me. I told you.
Amen.
Don't think at all. It's just something that you do night after night. It's only ever a question of time.
Nervous. I would be too if I were you. Near Dark.
Look at your boys falling in the control.
Check out time.
Yourself some time, son.
God damn, this is my family. Let it go.
Near Dark. Pray for daylight. The night has its price.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary. Joining me, Mr. Mike White.
Hello.
And also joining us this week for another trip into the underworld of the Bloodsuckers, who seems to be stuck with us every time we talk about vampires, Mr. Edward G. Pettit. How are you, sir?
Very happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me again.
All right. This week, we're looking at the 1987 film from Kathryn Bigelow, Near Dark. The film stars Adrian Pasdar and Jenny Wright as a pair of star-crossed lovers, almost a Romeo and Juliet story, with May, Jenny's character, coming from the wrong side of the tracks. And she's part of a rather interesting nomadic family that keeps them rather odd hours and likes to wrap their cars in tinfoil like baked potatoes in order to keep the sun's rays from cooking them. The family includes Bill Paxton, Jeanette Goldstein, and Lance Henriksen, sort of making this a little mini Aliens reunion just about a year after that film. So, Ed, tell us about your history and what you think about Near Dark.
I love Near Dark. It is, along with Martin from George Romero, which you guys had me on the Projection Booth before, it is my other favorite vampire movie. I either saw Near Dark when it first came out in the theaters in 87, or it was soon out on videotape, but I must have seen it then in the late 80s. And I loved it from the start, but I still do. I rewatch and I've taught it a couple times at LaSalle University. But I think one of the reasons why I did love it is because it came out at the same time as The Lost Boys, and I felt like I had to hate The Lost Boys. And because it was very slick and hip, and it was clearly designed for a kind of mass market audience. Lost Boys is okay, but I think Near Dark was kind of like the opposite. It was very much the indie kind of, you know, independent vampire flick of its day. And I think I almost had to like it because of that reason. And it still is. It's still so very different than almost every vampire movie I see.
Well, I mean, the one thing we talk about Near Dark is the fact that nobody ever says the V word in the film. So,
yeah,
so that kind of puts it out there. And then the thing is that it's, from my understanding, was right. Catherine Bigelow actually wanted to make a Western. So
yeah.
When you watch it, there's all these elements. There's like the kind of the Western, and then there's a biker film element, but there's no bikes, and then there's vampires,
yeah.
But they don't say the word vampire. And
it's an outlaw movie. It's missing all the usual vampire tropes, all that gothic setting. There's a bit of, and it's especially because this is the time that it's made, it's a John Hughes kind of romantic comedy, in a sense. I mean, a twisted, dark comedy, but it's made at that same time. I think it has the feel of that the romance that they're going through, to me, feels very much like a romance that happened in those teen movies in the 80s, which I loved then, too. I think that was part of the reason why I liked it so much. And Jenny Wright was actually a kind of on the outskirts of the Brat Pack. She's in a few of those Brat Pack movies. Jenny Wright plays May in the movie, the girl vampire. And she was in St. Elmo's Fire and a couple others. And so it had that feeling then, too. And I think that actually plays into the movie. I think I feel those, I see those rhythms of those kind of John Hughes romances going through this movie. And so it's this bizarre hybrid film.
Yeah, I'm remaining a little more quiet on this episode. I remember renting this one in like maybe 88, 89. And I was very intrigued by seeing Paxton and Lance Henriksen on the front. And I'm actually a big Bill Paxton fan. I don't know how many people actually can say that with a straight face, but I am. I actually like Bill Paxton quite a bit.
Me too. I love Bill Paxton. God.
Well, good. Chet, forever.
I always think Chet when I see him. And I will see a movie that he is in because he is in it.
How about a nice, greasy pork sandwich served in a dirty ashtray.
Well, good. I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Even in a terrible movie like Titanic, he gives it a little lift.
Yeah, it's too bad that he's only there at the beginning and the end, and it's like, oh, come on, get back to Bill. Well, with this one, it's like when you suggested that we do this one on the show, I was like, yeah, Near Dark, I don't really remember liking that one too much. And then I went back and I rewatched it, and I was like, yeah, I don't really like this movie that much. So I had kind of a hard time going back and rewatching this movie. It's kind of like, it just feels very oddly paced to me a lot of times. Like, I know it's supposed to be slow and it's not supposed to be so bang up and stuff, but it just feels sometimes like it's missing something, and I don't know what that is. And I don't think it's the use of the V word, but I think it's just there's something not there. And then even when it comes to something like the music, the Tangerine Dream score, it's just like, this doesn't feel like it fits with this film. I don't know what it is, but there's just something very off-putting about Near Dark, and I want to like it. I mean, I love the people that are in it, especially the vampire family. And I will say, I wasn't a big Lost Boys fan either, even though it was great to see Alex Winter in that movie. But yeah, I wasn't turned on by either of these vampire films from the summer of 87.
But yeah, I almost think the Tangerine Dream is off-putting to me, that soundtrack. And the pacing is really odd in this. And I think it's probably because it's a hybrid movie, but it's also all those things, I think. I don't know. I guess it makes it more watchable to me. Like, I don't know what to expect next, you know, pace-wise and the story-wise, and it's kind of, you know. And so I like the way it develops that way because it feels off. Not because I don't know what's going to happen. It's not that unpredictable in a movie, but it is off.
One of the things that I really appreciate about it is that it has all those elements, like we talked about. It does have the Western and the biker, the outlaw film, vampire film, and all that stuff. And then they're like these little, jokes and like little things on the genre. Like, it's a genre piece, but at the same time, it's making fun of it, or its characters are living with this certain sort of history in a way. I mean, there's lines in there where Lance Henriksen's character is like,
"There's something I'm meaning to ask you."
"Yeah, what might that be?"
"How old are you?"
"Let's put it this way. I fought for the South."
"South?"
"We lost."
And then Bill Paxton's character says, hey, you remember that time we started the fire in Chicago? And then you've got the kid who actually is a young, you know, he's a young boy physically, but he's an old man. So there's all of this elements of how they've been sort of surviving and being dragged along, I guess, in like stolen cars, Winnebagos, however they've been doing this. As a matter of fact, I actually think it might be more interesting to take this film and set it back during the Western days, you know, sort of something like Vertigo Comics has this thing called American Vampire. And I think that there's an element of the Western, like in the 1800s with the vampires. And I think that's kind of interesting. But since we don't have that in this film, it's still kind of interesting to have all of these different elements that kind of play together. And then, you know, this romance that's in there. But to me, I think really when I talk about why I like the film is that I see it as sort of this of the pulls of families. And what I mean by is like your actual family versus the family that would adopt you because you're an outsider or a freak, or maybe you've gotten into, you know, a certain music scene or drugs or something. And there seems to be this tension between the two families, the father and the sister trying to find Caleb, Adrian Pasdar's character, and then Lance Henriksen as the father of that family trying to get this one acclimated to their lifestyle too.
And you even get the kind of showdown on between the two parents, that when the two dads are in the same room, both fighting over who's going to get to have, you know, Caleb as his son.
Go on after your buddy home.
You're going after a mob.
Hold on a second there, Pilgrim. Remember which side of the bread your brother's on. God damn, this is my family. Let him go.
The question is whether they'd let us go. They've been tracking us. Now they know our faces. I say, kill them.
I've had about enough of this shit. Let go, my boy. You. Let go, my little girl. Daddy, put that away. It ain't gonna do no good.
What do you mean, ain't gonna do no good?
I listen to you, son.
I'd step right there if I was you, mister.
Not likely.
I would love to teach this as, and if I could teach a Western film course, I would consider putting this in, because structurally it really holds together as a Western. If you think about just kind of the basic story elements, it's about this farm boy, this rural farm boy who's dissatisfied with the like rural life that he's had to live from, you know, generations and his father, and he wishes, and he says, "I wish I were a million miles away." Then he gets mixed up with a group of outlaws. And then he realizes that he's not really an outlaw and he needs to return home. But of course he has to have this showdown, which he does very much in the middle of the street, wears the hat, rides the horse. And then at the end he gets the girl and he realizes that I really like this simple rural life. You know, he's like very Gary Cooperish at the end. I mean, that's a Western, and that's clearly what I think. I read somewhere Catherine Bigelow said her and Eric Red had sat down to write a Western. But they couldn't, they realized they wouldn't be able to sell a Western. So they needed to give it another element. And that was just, well, let's make it a horror film and then we can modern day it. But it's still, I think at its root elements, at its heart, I think it's still a Western film.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about Eric Red when we did the Hitcher episode. And I have to say, I went back and I read the script of this, and I don't know if this is like pre-Bigelow. Her name was not on it, and there were some differences between what was on the page and what ends up on the screen. And the script is amazing. It is so well written. It's not necessarily written like a screenplay 100%. There aren't kind of these blocks of actions that are happening. It's more like single sentences, just kind of describing things, just beautiful kind of stuff. I mean, we'll hear from Lance Henriksen later on, and he calls it poetry, and it was very much like poetry. It didn't rhyme, but it was, you know, blank verse kind of thing describing these scenes, and it was really good. And the thing that I really kind of felt like they lost between the page and the screen was caring about the characters, because I could really kind of get into Caleb's mindset reading it a lot more than I could watching it. And I don't know if that was necessarily a fault of the directing, the acting. Adrian Pasdar is not somebody who I think is very naturally charismatic on screen. He plays a really good villain, but as far as like our hero, I had a hard time kind of identifying with him. If anything, I really wanted to know more about the Paxton, Hendrickson, and Goldstein characters. I was just like, yeah, I want to know about these. Because even when it came to May, I was like, yeah, I don't really care about her either.
I loved her. She was so hot in the 80s, especially. I've since met Jenny Wright, who played May, at a horror convention a couple of years ago. And it was really nice to meet her. Actually, John Amplis from Martin was at the same convention, oddly enough. And so it was heaven for me. But I got my picture taken with Jenny Wright. She's not the young hottie that she was. But she's had a hard life since then, I think. She went down a kind of party girl route and didn't come out the other end very well, so to speak. But you mentioned the script. I have it in front of me. Just let me read this very opening of it, because you're right, it is. It almost is written like a poem, because it's just single lines across the page, and they're always short lines, and it's fade in. A mosquito alights on a human arm. The stinger injects in the warm flesh. The insectile body becomes full and red as it sucks the blood. The fist of the arm clenches. The forearm muscles tighten, trapping the stinger. The mosquito struggles to pull its needle-like appendage free. The tendons of the arm hold it firm, forcing blood into it. The insect struggles, blood engorges it, swelling its body. It swells, pops in a spritz of blood. I mean, it's like a little poem that starts off the script, and the whole script is like that. Very little mention of shots or close-ups or anything like that. It's just these little descriptive sentences all through the entire script that describe everything and the characters and what they're thinking and all that. It's a beautiful script, but it is missing that Bill Paxton humor. The best scene in the movie, of course, is my favorite Bill Paxton scene of all time, is the one where they go into the bar and kill everybody in it. And he is hilarious. And I think maybe one of those lines is in the script. Everything else is they came up with, I'm assuming, when they were shooting it.
Yeah, it felt like that scene in the script took a lot shorter amount of time. It moved a lot faster than what we finally ended up with. Because as I was watching that scene in particular, I was just like, boy, this is taking a long time. I know that the tension was supposed to be building and everything, but I just felt like it was just kind of clunky at times. I was like, come on, we really, let's amp it up. Let's get this thing going. You know, it reminded me of the scene in From Dusk Till Dawn.
What, were they psychos? Or?
They look like psychos? Is that what they look like? They were vampires. Psychos do not explode when sunlight hits them. I don't give a fuck how crazy they are.
Where they go into the titty twister, and you know something bad is going to happen, but you don't necessarily know what it is. And, you know, it's kind of the shoes on the other foot in this place. And I very much am making sure I put the word foot in there because of that famous scene. But it feels like, okay, something bad is going to happen, and, you know, who's unaware, who knows what's going to happen. You know, the bikers would, of course, think that they have the upper hand on these bunch of yahoos that come in there until, you know, the blood starts pouring. But it feels like once the blood starts pouring, it's not this kind of, like, bat-ish crazy scene that it really needs to do. But I don't know. It just felt kind of ham-handed the way that the direction was being handled. And I know this was Bigelow's first time solo out of the gate, but then looking at some of her other works too, it's like, even looking at, like, you know, Point Break and stuff, it's like Point Break's another one where I rented it once and I've never really wanted to go back to it, because it's like I just don't want to hang out with these guys. And I kind of felt the same way when I was done with Near Dark.
I agree with you on the bar scene. I think it is a few beats too long, but I always found the film interesting, like I said, because of sort of this battle of the families and things like that. But it's not something that I go back to all the time. I think that repeated viewings for me has lessened it, but I still enjoy it. It doesn't hold up as well for me as maybe Martin does, like when we talked with Ed before, but I still enjoy it. I think it's rather well done.
Yeah, I'm not trying to bring you guys down or anything. I feel bad.
No, I feel awful.
No, I feel bad for being this way.
This does actually, this film has actually improved upon, you know, viewings for me. I'm catching a little more. There's little touches that I catch that I hadn't noticed in the past. That bar scene where they kill everybody, I love the pacing of that, because Bigelow just takes her time and then just shows her characters killing each one of these people in this kind of humorous or inventive way. It's mostly Bill Paxton being crazy and having fun. And not only do I like that, but I am certain by 1987 I had never seen a vampire movie do those kinds of things. And that was just a blast to watch.
I am and ain't been shaved. It's finger licking good. Hey, Jess, I got smell like a Deadpool cat.
Now, lots of them do it now, and maybe it can seem not as good as that all those inventive little funny kills can seem not as great because so many more people have done them. But at the time, it was a real shocker for me, and I still like it. I mean, finger looking good, and this guy smells like a dead polecat, and I hate it when they ain't been shaved, and you know, there are lines that, and Paxton can do the delivery. You know, I mean, Schwarzenegger wishes he could come up with great lines like that after his kills in his movies, and he never does. But this movie still holds up for me, and that scene especially, I could show that scene over and over. My class always gets to see that movie at least twice. Or that scene at least twice.
That is a good point as far as the shot glass filled with blood. That definitely hadn't been seen at that point. I mean, I'm thinking as far as even up until the early 80s, you know, there was the Franklin Gilla remake of Dracula that was in 78, I want to say. And then you had, you know, Love at First Bite, where it was kind of mocking the vampire films. But really, you didn't have that kind of vampire cross-genre kind of thing too often. Definitely not like you have today, where it's like, okay, now it's vampires in space. Even though you did have the Steve Railsback film and everything, but not necessarily vampires. But yeah, so it was just it was very inventive to do that. And it was interesting because I can't really think of a whole lot of Western vampire films that were happening until then. And now it's like, okay, well, John Carpenter's Vampires and the From Dusk Till Dawn series. And I'm sure, you know, just thinking very briefly, it's like you can come up with several more titles, I'm sure. It's like, well, maybe 30 Days of Night you could kind of throw in there as far as the lone sheriff against all the criminals that move into town, those kind of things. But yeah, this was, it was ahead of its time as far as that went.
And there have been plenty of vampire movies, though, in present modern-day settings. Except for Martin, they would always have still these gothic trappings, gothic sensibilities about them. And
right. Near Blackula Dark, or something like that.
Or any of them. And Near Dark, though, kind of sets it in, you know, it's like the American Southwest. I mean, that's the last place you ever expect to deal with vampires in, you know, movies up to 1987. The setting does it, and also in that, and the ballroom scene, which I'll keep coming back to because I love it, the great difference between Lance Henriksen's character, Jesse, and Bill Paxton's, which for me really carries the whole movie. It's Rob mentioned earlier, that's the relationship that's so great, but it is. I mean, that carries the whole film, and how over-the-top Bill Paxton plays everything, and then how menacing and understated Lance Henriksen plays his Jesse. I love that interplay for that whole scene, and really for the whole movie.
And then on top of it, I mean, we talked about this at the top and kind of, you know, from piece to piece a little bit, but the idea of taking, okay, all of this stuff, and then we're going to throw romance on top of it. And this was the place where I've told people who are like, oh, I love the Twilight films. And I'm like, you know what? Go watch Near Dark, because for some reason, Near Dark, I can stomach. Twilight, I cannot. And their relationship to me is interesting because I think it says something about just what I and this is going to sound cynical, the parasitic nature of relationships, because there's this whole thing where he refuses to kill and he has to feed off her from time to time. And there's this sort of back and forth feeding thing that goes on. And I think it makes an interesting comment on maybe cynically the feeling about relationships, maybe even in the mid-late 80s.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a shame that, you know, that the ending does not reflect that as well. You know, that you get the happy ending and she's saved. And I will grant you that the cure for vampirism in this movie is the worst plot element of it.
Yeah, really, yeah, I agree with you.
It's just a blood transfusion? Big deal? Like, really? That's all it took?
Well, plus anyway, I mean, we get the idea that, okay, the dad might be a rancher or something. What the hell is he going to know about pulling off a blood transfusion? He might be able to deliver a calf.
He was a large animal veterinarian.
Okay, well, there you go. He can deliver a calf, but what's he going to do, you know?
They teach that at MSU, how to cure vampirism.
But also, there's none of that other vampire stuff going on. You mentioned they don't say the word vampire, but with the exception of the sunlight hurting them, which is done so dramatically, so much more dramatically than, you know, vampire films in the past have usually done, with their skin's boiling and they're bursting in the flame. But all those other trappings are gone, crucifixes and garlic and, you know, nobody worries about reflections and any of that, and mirrors, any of that kind of stuff. It's just that all that little, that ridiculous, what can be ridiculous, magical, supernatural stuff isn't in this movie. And that then kind of makes the movie seem like it's real. Like, it seems as if this is what would happen if there were vampires in present day and you know, in the American Southwest, that they'd be violent, they'd be predatory killers, and they'd be like this outlaw band. And of course, when you think of it, it's like, well, no, nothing would ever happen like it happens in the movie. It's a movie, and it's, you know, it's an action movie. It's a little bit ridiculous, and the way the plot develops and the cops chasing them, they could never live that way for real. But because it's a vampire thing and we've taken out all the supernatural vampire stuff, I think that it gives the impression that this is real. And that really hit me watching it for the first time, and still hits me. I still watch it, and it might be one of those nostalgia things with me. I might watch this, and then my head turns to, like, you know, I'm 20 again or something, you know? That might be going on in my head. Every time I watch this, I might turn 20. But, and they're outlaws, you know? And that whole, they're so violent and so nasty, but, I mean, come on, you don't want to hang out with them? That is, they're so attractive in their kind of, you know, that Bonnie and Clyde way, that outlaw band and do whatever they please. And that's even appealing now to me, you know, as a middle-aged man, that it'd be nice to go off on that kick and just be able to kill awful people and, you know, and do whatever I want. And Caleb has to deal with that and realize that it's no good. But it's also that appeal of the outlaw mentality. You know, it's why I still watch Sons of Anarchy.
Now, Jeanette Goldstein, I'd like to hang out with her, definitely.
I only need to know one thing, where they are. Anytime, anywhere.
Right, right.
I figure this movie has to take place right around, like, June 19th, 20, 21st or something, because these guys never seem to realize when the sun is going to come up, and it always seems to take them by surprise. It's like, you guys have been vampires for 200, 300 years, whatever it is, 100 years, and you got, maybe have a watch or something that tells you when the sun's going to come up or something like that, because it's just like, the sun's coming up, we got to take cover. And it's like, that happens to them, what, like three times in the movie?
Well, if it was today, they would have an app for that. So, you know, they'd be all set.
There you go.
Well, they are planning, they did plan ahead to have plenty of foil and tape. So.
Yes. Black paint for the insides of the windows and everything. So I do have to say, Jeanette Goldstein is so hot in this movie.
She is.
So that peroxide blonde thing that she's got going on really works for me. More than Jenny Wright did, really. And I have to say, Jenny Wright, there were times where she really reminded me of Jennifer Jason Leigh. Like, every once in a while, her voice sounded like Jennifer Jason Leigh. And I was like, oh, that would have been good casting.
I could see that.
Yeah, it's just like, fuck you. I love Jenny Wright. I got my picture taken with her. I wouldn't get my picture taken with Jennifer Jason Leigh. I saw Last Exit to Brooklyn. I know what a whore she is.
You know, we talked a little bit about it so far, and talked a little bit about Near Dark, and also Twilight. So let's hear an interview with our good friend Mike Mayo, the author of The Horror Show Guide, The Ultimate Fright Fest of Movies.
Near Dark, you know, 1986, 87, this comes out, kind of comes out of nowhere. It's an interesting little film. Do you remember what your take was when you first saw it?
Yeah, it was one that I had heard about. I had heard, you know, this is really a terrific vampire movie, and I kept waiting for it to hit a theater near me, and it never did. And then I found it in a video store near me and brought it home and watched it and just went, wow, this is just such a great movie, in part because it is as much an action movie as it is a horror movie, and I'd never really seen those two brought together. I guess you could say that James Cameron's Aliens is both an action and a horror movie, and there's a lot of overlap between Aliens and Near Dark, but not in the way this one is. And to me, this was a movie that just visually, the whole way it looked, the way that it, like Martin, doesn't answer all of the questions that it poses. I thought that was really cool about it. And just the whole idea of it, that it was just played out so beautifully. And again, as I said before, I really felt like I entered that world. I was in that kind of interstate landscape there, where so much of it takes place, the bars and everything else. That was just, you know, wow. This is the world that I know, and here are these crazy characters moving through it, and this guy falls in with them, and it was one of those movies I remember watching it the first time. I had no idea what was going to happen next, and boy, that is one measuring line, I think, of a really good film. If you don't know what's going to happen next and you're surprised all the way through it, it's done something right.
You know, the thing that I really like about it, and you talked a little bit about it, is it's an action film, it's a horror film. I think that it has elements of a romance in there, and I would even say a Western to some extent. Like,
no, very much, yeah. Yeah, so much of it is an homage to Sam Peckinpah. Just the way things are set up and staged, I think the fight in the bar is something that I would... I'm not going to say it's equal to the final shootout in The Wild Bunch, but it's pretty close. It really does things right. And it's also got a sense of humor that you don't find in a lot of things. It's a very strange sense of humor, dark humor, but it's there. And again, this is one that I watched it the first time on VHS tape, then again a few years ago on DVD, and was just knocked out all over again because it is such a visually interesting film all the way through.
And the thing is, and not to play the, you know, the sexist card here, but to have it come out of a female director, and I think this may have been Kathryn Bigelow's first or second film, is
really, I think it was her first, though. I'm not positive about that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's pretty incredible too. I mean, to talk about sort of the viscera aspect, and people are like, oh, well, you know, women are a little more delicate. I think Kathryn Bigelow has shown over the career that she's not that delicate.
Not at all. And you really can follow, you know, that whole visual style and approach to action through all of her films, including more recently The Hurt Locker and to a lesser extent, Zero Dark Thirty. I think both of those films, particularly Hurt Locker, really use the action to move things forward. It's not just action for action's sake. You're revealing character and moving the plot forward in all of those scenes that are where another director would just, you know, have a bunch of guys fighting or shooting each other or things blowing up. They really do have a narrative purpose in her films, and that I think I have seen everything she's done. I may have missed some, but that to me has been what I've seen in all of her stuff. What's the one she did that's set in the future, the near future?
Strange Days?
Yes, Strange Days, yeah. Yeah, nice movie.
You know, it's funny that you brought up Aliens and talked about James Cameron and sort of that mix of horror and action, and the fact that these two ended up together for a time.
Yeah. and weren't they married when he made Aliens? And were they still married when she did Near Dark?
I think around that time they were together, yeah. So it's kind of interesting, as you were saying, that there is some crossover in that way. And you also talk about the cast.
Yeah, very much. Because Lance Henriksen is really big in both of them. And Paxton, too, Bill Paxton. And what's her name? Jeanette Goldstein. All of them are in Aliens.
Yeah, and it's great to see them in here, because I think the performances in Near Dark are incredible, and especially I think the one who gets overlooked, and I'm probably going to forget it right now in terms of me talking to you, is the one who plays the teenager. But I just think the performances in it are great. I mean, you just have a broad range of performances, and the other thing that's interesting about Near Dark is that it's a vampire film that never says the V word.
Right, yeah, and again, that's what's so cool about it. In the same way, it's what we were saying about Martin, in that this is a film that doesn't feel like it needs to answer every question, to you know, kind of cross every T and dot every I. It assumes that the viewer comes into it with some knowledge, and we're going to work from that, and you don't have to have everything explained to you, and at the end of it, everything is not going to be explained to you. I have criticized the movie at times for, I think, having the ending is a little bit weak compared to the body of the film. I would have preferred a slightly darker ending, but that is a quibble, because I think the whole film works so well and draws you into its world so well that I'm not going to really say that seriously at all. It is, any fan who hasn't seen Near Dark should stop whatever they're doing right now and go find a copy.
You know, if you've seen Near Dark and, you know, you're taking a listen to this, and obviously you're a reviewer, you've seen a lot of stuff, what's out there that if I like Near Dark, this is what I should see that maybe I've overlooked?
Ooh, well, we mentioned them earlier. 30 Days a Night, definitely, I think, of the newer vampire films, one of the best. And Let the Right One In. Even if you've seen Let Me In, see Let the Right One In. It is, I think, just one of the best recently because it is a foreign film and is subtitled. I think it just, a lot of people dismiss it right out of hand, and they shouldn't, because there's so much else going on. And I'm going to bring something here a little bit out of left field, because it's not actually a vampire film, but I think it deals with some of the same things we've been talking about, and that is Stephen King's Pet Sematary. To me, an underrated horror film that scares me, that shows me something new every time I watch it again, and just really has that kind of visceral, nasty quality that I want a really good horror movie to have, you know, to kind of scare me in a way that conventional films can't do. And the original Pet Sematary, not the sequel, avoid the sequel at all costs, but the original Pet Sematary is, I think, one of the ones that really stands up and should be seen again.
Anything else you want to add that maybe I forgot to ask you about?
Gosh, what else? You're giving me here a platform to sell myself, and I can't think of anything else other than to say to any horror fans out there who haven't gathered it from what we have already said, if you haven't seen Martin and Near Dark, you really need to. These are terrific movies. They're not splashy and crazy and overdone the way so many of contemporary horror movies are, but they tell really good, complicated stories that you'll get involved in, and you will remember scenes from these movies 10 years from now. And I'm not sure that you can say that about a lot of things that are released by the studios these days.
So, guys, you know, I just got done talking to Mike Mayo there, and want to thank Mike for coming on. He was also on the Martin episode. And we were chatting about sort of like, you know, pull Twilight out of the kids' hands and shove Near Dark in there. You know, maybe it's a little twisted in my mind, but I don't know. Maybe I'd rather have kids watch Near Dark. What do you think?
Well, they wouldn't know what to do with it, because because it's still a horror movie. I mean, Near Dark is, and it's very much a horror movie. I mean, and Twilight's not. Twilight takes the horror out of vampires and kind of, it's just, it's almost incidental that they're vampires. And, you know, they have superpowers, they're vampire powers and that kind of stuff, but it's not, they're not bad guys. I mean, yeah, I know there's bad guys in Twilight and the whole series and the whole way it develops, but not like Near Dark. I mean, this is, to make the choice to be with vampires means you're making the choice to murder people. And in Twilight, to make the choice to be with vampires means your life's going to be great.
Homer's not going to elementary school and hanging out and stuff. Yeah, you know, it made no sense to me why the vampires would go to high school. It's like, how old are you guys? Are you still going are you just looking for a way to throw off the bell curve, or what is it? It just makes no sense.
They're pedophiles, right? Is that it? They like the kids.
As a dad, watching Twilight is a creepy experience. Because that guy's like 100, and she's a teenager. And he might look like he's still a teenager, but he ain't. And I always have a different reaction. But I know that's a generational thing. If you're a teenager watching Twilight, it seems right. And I thought the Twilight films were very – the films of Twilight were very interesting. At least I've seen the first three, and that's it. Is it five now or six? I'm not sure. But I think – I don't like them as films, but I'm intrigued by them because they are completely made for this kind of teen viewpoint, and that all the things that I think of in those movies that are wrong about these characters, that are creepy, that he shouldn't be with this girl because he's really mature inside because he's an older man, the movie almost plays it like, well, no, that's fine. That's great. It's actually a better situation for her, which is the way the 16-year-old girl would think of it. And I thought it was unusual because usually when adults make movies for kids, there's this kind of overlay of morality that this, you know, finger shaking, you shouldn't do this, kids. And there's none of that in Twilight. And I think it's odd that it's okay. The relationship is okay in Twilight, in the movies and in the books, of course it is too. But in Near Dark, this stuff should be not okay. He said they're vampires.
Well, with Twilight, there's really sort of two objections I have. One is that vampires sparkling? I don't think so. The second one is that, and I didn't read the books, but it's a very chaste vampire. And like, even going back to like the original Dracula books, there was always this sort of like idea that vampires were of the flesh, that it was sort of a substitute for sex in some way in Victorian ways. And for Stephanie Meyer to pull all of the sexuality really in a way out and then sort of clean it and then hand it back is not very interesting, even though I know it's for teens.
I will say I did think of Twilight a couple times while I was watching Near Dark. One was looking at the Blu-ray DVD and just in horror, the way that they treated the artwork by making Near Dark have artwork like Twilight now, which is just awful. That pensive look on Caleb's face as he looks off to the side while May rests her head on his shoulder, and she has normal flesh color and he has that deathly pale and all this. But the one that really got me was, there's that really awkward scene where Adrian Pazdar is in the back of Tim Thomerson's truck.
What the goddamn hell's going on, son?
Well, I can't expect you to believe it. I can't believe it myself. I ain't a person anymore. I don't know what I am. I'm sick.
We're going to get you to the hospital right away.
You're doing up dead. No.
Caleb, those people back there, they wasn't normal. Normal folks, they don't spit out bullets when you shoot them. No, sir.
I bet. I got a bite.
We're going to get you to the hospital right away.
No! Goddamn, you want me killed? I ain't going to goddamn hospital! Hospital's fixed this! Damn it, Daddy! Let me home!
And I kept thinking of that stupid line, that stupid scene in Twilight where it's like, you're cold and you don't age and all this kind of crap.
You never eat or drink anything.
You don't go out in the sunlight. I know what you are.
Say it. Out loud.
Vampire.
It's like, oh, God. You know, it's like, I just wanted to say, just say vampire. Just say it, Caleb. You know, it's going to make it a lot easier because right now your dad's just kind of guessing, and I felt bad for Tim Thomerson in that scene.
You know, I kind of watched that and felt that made it more realistic in a sense. I mean, because, I don't know, I think I thought that, well, if you say, like, no, Dad, I'm a vampire, then it's going to seem ridiculous, and there's no way he's going to believe you.
Or you could take it to the next level and be like, you know, like I said, see it as a stand-in for maybe drug use or something. Be like, I can't admit I'm a junkie. I can't admit I'm on heroin or something.
True, true. Or it could be like Nicolas Cage and be like, I'm a vampire, I'm a vampire, I'm a vampire.
That's why I like that he puts his hand out the window and it burns. And I thought, well, yeah, that's a good way to demonstrate that there's something else, there's something going on here that you can't explain to him. And so, yeah, I kind of like that, too. I like a lot of stuff about this movie, only.
Well, then we picked the right co-host for this one, because otherwise I'd just be a big old stick in the mud.
he would just be pounding the hell out of me right now. I'm so glad you're here, Mr. Pettit.
I can totally see why people would like this movie, and I completely can see everything that you're saying. It's just for some reason, I just felt, like I said, like this distance from this movie, and it never really kind of brought me into its world. And I don't know if that was me being standoffish or just something else kind of pushing me away, but I was able to resist the vampire's curse.
Yeah, I like the whole cross-genre thing about it. And, you know, I love cross-genre books and movies now. And this one really still holds up for me. You know, the modern-day Western vampire romance. And it still holds up. And it's one of the few vampire romance films that holds up for me, even though I don't like the ending. I mean, there's no way they should be. And as Rob, as you mentioned, with the whole parasitic nature of the relationship, I mean, this film should end with him kind of having to destroy her or something. And I remember when I went back to the script after watching it, rewatching it again, thinking like, oh, did I just misremember? Does she die in the end of the script and I just forgot? No, she doesn't. So
yeah, the thing that we talked about a little bit before, you know, you were talking about the way that the sunlight comes through the windows and everything, those cool beams, and that was a really cool effect, and it was nice to see that kind of the laser effect of the sun. And that kept reminding me of Daybreakers, the Spirit Brothers film with Ethan Hawke and Willem Dafoe. Talk about cross-genre, you know, kind of the sci-fi futuristic vampire film. Love that film. Absolutely love that film. And it was kind of bad because it, like, watching Near Dark kept making me want to just kind of turn it off and put in Daybreakers, which that film completely surprised me. Like, I thought it was just going to be a real piece of junk, and then fell in love with it when I saw it and went back and rewatched it. I was like, yeah, this still holds up.
Well, I'll have to rewatch that because I saw it and I remember I liked it, but I didn't love it. Now I'll definitely rewatch that and think of it in light of this and how it crosses genres. And it's funny because now I'm not even sure if I don't even know if I thought of that as a movie that was a kind of cross-genre movie, and it is, just because maybe there's so many of them now, and that one, kind of, I miss thinking of it in that way.
Well, unfortunately, very much like Near Dark, it really didn't have the advertising behind it. You know, Near Dark, it's funny how many movies we've talked about on the show that were victims of the whole De Laurentiis fiasco, like when they closed down and went bankrupt and everything. There have been so many movies that were coming out right around that time that were just awesome and got, like, lost in that whole bankruptcy.
And this one did come out the same summer as The Lost Boys, which still had the big media push behind it.
That movie was made for MTV.
Yeah, and that was the one everybody was going to see, and Near Dark was just, you know, in and out of the theaters.
All right, we're going to take another break and play an interview with actor Lance Henriksen about his role in the film.
Hi, my name's Chris, and I've got Steven Seagal on the Old Dog and Bone. Steven,
Yes.
Have you ever desired to hear a weekly movie podcast hosted by two fellows from the northeast of England who run their little hands through the week's movie news and then cap it off with a review or two, ranging from all sorts of genres, kung fu, anime, straight-to-video tomfoolery, bit of horror? Well, you're a dick who doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't even know why I'm asking you. I'm sure there's other people out there who have desired to hear such a thing. So if you're one of those lovely people, pop on over to wafufm.com. That's wafufm.com and check out the show. You can also find us on iTunes, TalkShoe, and Facebook at facebook.com/wafublog. Wafu FM, it's a podcast that's good and stuff. Shut up, Stephen.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women and men and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other .coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
Do you enjoy old-time movies? What about old-time radio? What about old-time prices? Well, if the answer is yes to any of these questions, then head over to CheesyFlicks.com. If you're in the mood for some blaxploitation, martial arts, horror, sci-fi, sword and sandal, action and adventure, or anything else that might float your boat for in front of the old boob tube, then CheesyFlicks.com has what you need at bargain bin prices. CheesyFlicks.com also has one of the largest MST3K libraries available online, all at low-down, dirt-cheap prices. CheesyFlicks.com, the official sponsor for the B-Movie Bargain Bin Podcast.
Hey, it's Rob St. Mary from the Projection Booth, and, you know, I want to tell you about a guy, kind of humble guy, I guess. My podcast partner. That's right, he has a new book out. His name's Mike White, and it's called Cinema Detours. The guy's so humble, he won't even bring it up on the show. I don't know what that's all about, but anyway, just want to say Cinema Detours got a chance to take a look at it, read through it, and it's kind of fun. I mean, you have these reviews for movies that you've probably seen before, and it's like chatting with an old friend, and then there's the movies that you haven't seen, which you got to add to your list, and hopefully you get to see before you die. Thanks a lot, Mike, for telling me about all these movies that I got to see now. But really, ultimately, why I'm coming to you about why you should pick up Cinema Detours, either at Amazon.com or for your Kindle, or you can go over to projection-booth.com and pick it up as well, is because, you see, Mike's wife told me to do this. You might not know this, but Mike has 37 children, and he needs the money in order to take care of them. 37 kids, can you imagine? So Cinema Detours, projection-booth.com. You can always get it at Amazon, either in paper form or for your Kindle. So check it out. It's Mike White, Cinema Detours. And now I know why I don't get paid for this podcast.
Well, thank you again. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. You know, we spoke, it was probably about a year ago when you were doing your turnaround for your book and everything, talking about The Visitor, which is now Alamo Drafthouse has picked that up. So it's going to be coming out for more people to see, which is great.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So be prepared for that.
The most difficult movie to comprehend. Yeah.
I'm not really sure why they picked that one up of all films, but I enjoyed it. So.
Well, because it has... Glenn Ford, Shelley Winters, Mel Farrar, John Huston, they're all in it, you know, so it's like a, you know, brand names, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
Something like that. Shit.
So we're doing a show on Near Dark.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it. Sure.
How did you get involved with the project, first off?
Well, the first thing that happened was Bill Paxton called me out of the blue. We had finished Aliens, and Bill called me and said, hey, Lance, I just read a script. You got to read this thing, man. And I said, oh, yeah? What's it about, Bill? And he goes, well, it's a vampire Western. And I said, check, please. You know, like, what are you talking about? And then my agent sent the script to me, you know, and it read beautifully. It was Eric Red and Catherine Bigelow had written it, and it was written like poetry. I mean, it was an elegant, beautiful script, and the story was great. And so I went to meet Catherine about it, and I hadn't talked to Bill. I found out that I got the role of Jesse Hooker, and just from a meeting. And what I found out later was that she wanted Jeanette and Bill and I in it because we had done Aliens together, and it was, the story is a family story. I mean, believe it or not, you know, and you know, these people trust and like each other and know each other and all of that stuff. So we had, that was on purpose. We had all been hired directly out of Aliens. And so, then I found out on the first day of rehearsal that Bill was in it and Jeanette was in it. And, you know, then I met Adrian Pasdar and Jenny Wright. Anyway, so all of that happened. And that's just before the movie even started. We were all happy because we knew that we were into something of quality. And also Catherine Bigelow, you know, I really have a great affection for her because she's an artist, and she presented us with issues that we had to solve, like how do you get into a sunshiny room and protect yourself? And we would improvise all kinds of stuff. And I asked for certain things, like I wanted my coat and I wanted a rebel flag sewn on the inside of it, and you know, that kind of stuff. And everything was granted to us that was positive toward the story, which is great. So it was a great experience. I mean, a tremendous experience.
Yeah, how was it working with Catherine? This was only her second feature as director, I think.
Yeah, her first feature was co-directed. This was her real first alone, you know, standalone thing, you know. But she was great. I mean, she was a matriarch. And she was like the other nocturnal nomad. You know, we didn't call them vampires. We called ourselves nocturnal nomads, which is more in keeping with what we actually did.
What was the chemistry like between you and Bill and Jeanette having worked together?
How does it sound? we were a tight-knit group, man. Really, really a trusting, tight-knit group.
Yeah, I like that you guys are kind of a family. I mean, there is a definite mother, father, son.
Sure, sure. And Jeanette was the mother, and we had this strange young kid with us. But anyway, it was quite a phenomenon, that movie. I mean, most of it was shot at night, and so we were constantly working all night and then eating our breakfast at a truck stop in the morning, you know, because we were out in the middle of Arizona, Coolidge, Arizona. So it was a great feat. It really was. Some of it was shot in California, but most of it was shot out in Arizona.
Now, I know the way that the film feels, it feels very claustrophobic with you guys always having to be in these kind of smaller, dark areas for your daytime scenes and everything. Was it kind of a claustrophobic set, or how was that kind of working close quarters with everyone?
Oh, it's you know, it serves you. You know, it's not like anything is a problem. There were no problems on that movie. It was, you know, the only problem was fatigue from working nights. I mean, your body doesn't get adjusted to that for a long time. So, but other than that, it was we loved it. I mean, Bill Paxton walked around with a black umbrella all the time. I mean, you know, when you look back on it, you have 20/20 sight, you know, and right around the same time that we came out, Lost Boys came out, which was very, to me, it was a very frivolous, I don't know, kind of goofy, you know, and that was just my opinion. But I think at the time, De Laurentiis went bankrupt at the same moment we were coming out. The movie was being released, so our ads in the paper were the size of business cards, I think. You know, they weren't very big. It's become its own cult thing, you know. I mean, it's not like we could do anything to help that movie along, but people, everywhere I go, people talk about that film. You know, they really... that connected with it somehow. I remember talking to Chartoff and Winkler because we, Bill and I, from the minute we finished the movie, were saying, we ought to do a prequel, man. I mean, we got to do a prequel. And so I went to Chartoff and said, you know, we want to do a prequel. And Chartoff said, well, why? I mean, well, these people were monsters. I mean, why would anybody want to see that? And I said, the same reason they liked it in the first place. It's how they care about each other that makes it work. You know, that they fight with each other and for each other, you know? So that to me was the key to the whole movie. I mean, and Catherine was right about that.
How did you go about kind of getting into the skin of Jesse Hooker? What was your approach for this one?
I had written a whole kind of background on him, you know, to get ready for any part. I'd do the same thing. I mean, I wrote where he came from, how he got turned, all of that stuff, and which made it really work for me. But it was the case of, you know, that Jesse came from the Southern Navy, and that he had been sailing on an ironclad, but it still has wooden decks, and that after a battle in the Chesapeake, they lost the battle, and most of the men were killed, but there were like a half a dozen or so, including Hooker, that were laying on the decks, and their chests were ripped open from splinters of wood and from the battle, and they were steaming into the night air, and these harpies started feeding on the dying men, and that one of them took pity on Jesse Hooker, and he became what he was. And so I did all of that because that's the way to do it. I mean, you really want to know kind of where you came from. And I remember I put a pigtail on my hair and was dipped in tar. And that, you know, I mean, the flag I had in my coat was from the ship. So anyway, that kind of thing, you know, you build it and you keep building it, and Catherine would add to it and add to it and add to it. And as a conspiracy, we did good work, you know, all of us.
That's quite a good conspiracy to have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the best that acting becomes. I mean, it becomes that kind of thing. And maybe in your lifetime, you may do a handful of films that have that kind of incredible communion, you know. So, yeah. That's good stuff, man.
How was it working with Josh Miller?
He was a very professional kid. And the ironic part was that, you know, he was so eccentric. Like we all are. I'm sure he looked at me and said, you're eccentric, too. But, you know, he was the youngest of the group, except for the daughter, the veterinarian, Tim Thomerson's daughter, you know, in the movie. He was into it, but he was in his own realm. I mean, he kind of was like any kid. He was, whatever the family was doing was okay with him. And he, you know, his dancing and his tantrums and all of that stuff was almost so age appropriate and so perfect that it was, we never worried about it. It was really good stuff, really good stuff.
Now, I know you've worked with Tim quite a few times, and you're working with him with Bring Me the Head of Lance Henriksen.
Yeah.
That seems to be like it's going to be coming out pretty soon?
I have no idea, no. Michael, we've already shot it all. Michael Wirth is editing it and all that kind of stuff, you know, so I don't know. I have no idea.
That'll be interesting seeing your name not just, you know, above the title or as part of the credits, but yeah, as part of the title itself.
I know. It's a crazy thing. I mean, I heard about it. Well after it had already started, and I called Michael Wirth, who was the director producer, and I said, hey man, you never even called me. You're using my name and you're not even calling me. And then he explained it to me, and it was a pretty funny conversation, really, because I worked with Michael once and he was directing something I was in, and he's a good guy, a really good guy, so I appreciated it. And then we, you know, the whole thing is improvised. There isn't a script. The whole thing. I mean, it's really a story about Tim Thomerson. He's an actor that every time he goes in for a role, it's either been offered to me or you know, I already have the role. You know, so he gets so frustrated, he starts stalking me to find out how I do it. You know?
I can so see you having a great time doing improv work.
Oh, I loved it. We had so many laughs. I mean, it wasn't just us laughing, but people that were witnessing what was going on. It is some funny, and there's really a lot of very talented people in it, you know, that are, it's really also about ageism in the industry, that after you get a, reach it, after you're 40, you start, roles start disappearing and, you know, and that kind of thing. But I've had a career that's not ending. It's not stopping. I just got back from Montreal doing a movie with Mamoru Oshii, who's a great director and another one of those great experiences. But and I'm going to Dallas to go work, and then I'm going to Germany to do another film. So I'm very busy. And you know, I mean, to do an improvised comedy about all of the frustrations of this industry is, and talk real shit, not just you know, not pandering for your next job. You know, I mean, it's talking about all the difficulties and all of the absurdities of life as an actor. You know, which is great.
Yeah, it seems like you've got a lot of stuff in the hopper. Are you? I know that you came out with a comic book.
Oh yeah, Dogs Comics. Yeah, the fifth comic is available now. You know, we did a five comic series, and the reason it's five comics, that's 22 pages each, and five comics, that's a movie script. We worked on it a year and a half. I mean, that's a long time. Really happy with it.
How was that, doing the kind of, because I know you worked with Joseph doing the autobiography. How was it doing the comic writing?
It was fantastic, because Joseph and I and Tom Mandrake, we spoke on Skype like every other day, you know, through the whole run of this thing. And we honed it and you know, brought it to life. It's pretty amazing. It really is. It's a great comic. I'm not just saying it because I did it, but I did it with two other people. So it's Mandrake's art is just beautiful. Well, it's all the same thing. I mean, it's all storytelling, and it's all about expression, and it's all about labor, and it's all about, you know, all the things that, and not so much all the things that society is asking you to do. It's all the things that you feel is necessary to live in the society. So, you know, that kind of thing.
So what else should we be looking out for you?
Oh, man. I'm not very close to the end yet, buddy. I'm really doing a lot of work, and I'm loving every minute of it. Yeah, there's some really good movies coming out. You know, in January, I think The Last Druid, The Garm Wars is coming out. And so, you know, a lot of the work is starting to surface now, you know, finished. Yeah, so I'm really blessed in that respect.
When you were starting out as an actor, what was kind of the turnaround time between being done with shooting and a movie coming out compared to these days? Is it always just kind of a different timeline?
It's always different based on the budget. Always, you know. I mean, when you have a very big budget, you have to protect yourself. You know, you have to protect the money. And they want to get it out quick, but with quality, because, you know, they're paying interest on the money that they used. So they do want to get it out there. Everybody does. But you don't want to rush it out there and have a piece of crap on your hands, you know, where all the money is lost or whatever, you know. So I mean, it's all logical. I mean, it's all logic. There are some very talented people out there guarding the money, and there's also some very talented people out there making demands so that the piece of work that they all agreed to ends up on the screen.
Yeah, I wasn't sure with, like, computer effects, if that is added or made it easier or,
you know, just... Again, it really comes down to how you use it. In the early days, it was all physical effects, and that went on a long time, and then CG came out, and I thought, well, they're only going to use this shit... you know, to do things that can be done no other way, like poetry. You know, you if you say Pinocchio, you want to make his nose grow. I mean, I don't know. And you could do that as a physical effect, but still, you know, I'm talking about maybe in a more poetic way they would use CG, and I think some of them do. But, you know, there's something great about real tangible effects, you know, that are real effects that people make and they, you know, and they create, that I like an awful lot because I come from that era, you know. But CG, I don't know, man. I mean, when it's overused, it just, there's a vacuum between the CG and all the wonder of that and the audience, you know. I mean, Robert Downey in the third Iron Man was what saved that movie. That movie was suddenly a bunch of skyrockets flying around in those suits. And for the audience, it meant nothing. It was a lot of bang for no bucks, you know what I mean? It was just, but Downey, just with that kid and the jokes and it, and his timing and everything is so good that it made that movie palatable, you know?
You are not one to shy away from doing a lot of stunts on your own. What was it like doing the stunts for Near Dark, or what was it like? Because there were so many dangerous situations in there, so much fire in that film.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember you kind of getting set on fire in Hard Target. Did you volunteer for being set on fire in Near Dark as well?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, it wasn't dangerous at all. It was controlled. I'm not afraid of that shit when I'm around professionals, you know. I mean, I've held hundreds of guns in my hand for movies and fired thousands of rounds and never came close to hurting anybody or getting hurt. But it's always because there'd be an armorer like Mike Tristano or one of the great armorers that work in the industry that really protect you. I mean, they know their shit, and, you know, they really, their reputation is based on how well and how safe they are, you know. I mean, the other physical stuff, throwing myself around and fights or whatever it is, that's okay. I'm pretty agile. You know, I don't tense up and I don't smack people in the fucking mouth. You know, excuse my French, but you know what I mean? I mean, I've got a lot of control, but it comes from, you know, back in the days when I was doing theater, I was on a stage and blocking became so natural to me because of theater. You know, lots of plays where you had to hit a mark. The whole play is creating it with language. So you have to hit marks all over during the whole play. And so by the time I got into movies, I had an automatic sense of blocking, which I could trust. So it never made me tense, and it never made me, I've been punched, but I've never actually hit anybody. I hit a guy in the nose with a .45 once, but just the tip of his nose, because he didn't set himself. When you're supposed to do an up close thing, you have to set yourself, and you also have to look in the other guy's eyes, and that's where you automatically, your body knows the distance, so you never hurt anybody. But this guy kept moving forward, and I was leaning all the way over backwards, looking at him and looking in his eyes, and I swung it and barely clipped the tip end of his nose. But he just got a blood blister, that was it. But I'm talking 200 movies we're talking about. So that's my record, you know. I mean, I haven't hurt anybody. I kicked under the arm where my ribs were cracked and shit like that, you know. But that's me getting hurt, not them.
Right.
Oh, well, I'm skilled, yeah. I'm skilled. I've been doing it a long time. And I love it, and I don't bore myself. I'm not ever bored at all. You're in Detroit, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, buddy, Detroit, wow. I was just there working not too long ago, and I thought, that can happen to any city.
What were you here for?
I was here making a movie, you know, making a film in Detroit.
I meant which one. I figured it was a movie.
Yeah, it's called Needle Stick.
Okay.
It was fun. A very independent, small movie, but I enjoyed it. All right, buddy. You take care, Mike.
Thank you. You too. Thanks again.
Bye-bye, buddy.
Back talking about Near Dark, one of the more unusual vampire flicks around. But as we talked a little bit before the interview with Lance Henriksen, you know, cross-genre now is kind of what you expect. You can't just go to the movie theater and see a vampire film anymore. You can't just go to the movie theater and see a zombie film anymore. Now it's, you know, a zombie western in space with Rip Taylor in it. But anyway, there's all of this stuff going on now.
Now that I would see. I could see him like throwing the confetti and stuff. This is what keeps the zombies away.
There you go. So whether it be cross-dressing or cross-genre, what do you think, gents? You talked to a few of them, but what do you think in terms of ever since 1987 or so, sort of looking at maybe Near Dark as the one that sort of maybe helped to nudge the door open a little bit now that we've got the door fully kicked open and cross-genre seems to be the way to go. What is worth your time if we're talking about cross-genre vampire films?
Well, I think it's good and it's bad. I mean, it's good in the sense that finding new ways to tell stories is always good. I mean, you want to be inventive. You want to, you know, tweak something. And if you put it through the, if you see something through this lens that you, you know, a different color lens that you normally used to seeing it, then you see different things and it changes. And that's always nice for stories. It's bad in that it becomes a crutch, I think, for a lot of, you know, especially studios who really can't come up with original, or who refuse to come up with original screenplays and ideas anymore. So they just kind of think, well, let's just cobble this together and like some kind of, you know, Frankenstein creature. And it usually doesn't work because it could be a way of being lazy and making a movie. I think that, you know, when you find good examples, you know, for me, Near Dark, it can work great, but that has to come from, you know, an original idea to begin with and something that kind of hadn't been done. And maybe it had been, but I don't think there was, you know, a modern day Western vampire film until 1987. So
you said the word Frankenstein and cobbled together pretty close to one another. And for some reason, what sprang to mind was that horrible Van Helsing movie from a few years ago, which tried to do different stuff. And this whole, like, we're going to reimagine these old vampire hunters as these kick-ass people and blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like, I think they did it right with, like, Hansel and Gretel witch hunters, but did it completely wrong when it came to Van Helsing, which looked really good. Great look to that film. And again, talk about some hot ladies and everything, but just, it was a video game movie. I mean, as they're running across the gorge on the bridge, it's falling apart. I'm like, oh, this is like level 6 and now you got to get away. And, you know, eventually you'll be able to turn into a werewolf and fight the vampire at the end. It's like, oh, this was ridiculous. Talk about a bad example. I know we were supposed to talk about good ones, but that was a bad one. The other thing that Near Dark kind of brings to mind too, and I would say is a good example of this versus a bad example, was the Underworld series, another kind of star-crossed lover kind of thing. And I have to say, Near Dark did that much better than Underworld. I'm not a big fan of that series of films.
Yeah, that one doesn't. I haven't even seen all of them, so. And that's rare for me. I'll usually see all the kind of movie, just like I've seen all of the Resident Evil movies, because I feel like I need to, because they're zombie movies.
I have seen all the Resident Evil movies, and I actually enjoyed them until that last one. That one just, I'd rather somebody just punch me in the face a few times rather than watching that one ever again.
Well, I think they became kind of just video game shoot 'em ups, you know, around the second one, and continue to do that. But I think you're right. Van Helsing is for me the perfect example of, let's try to, you know, cross genre this and make something, you know, different. But it's not. It's just this big spectacle that you can't. So, and there are some, like the whole opening creation scene of the Frankenstein is really well done. And but it's just, you know, none of it fits together. None of that movie fits together. So.
Heading back to the classroom, you said before we were talking about Martin that you've shown that, and then Near Dark you show this, and, you know, what is the reaction from, I guess, the kids to watching Near Dark?
They liked this much more than they liked Martin. Martin was just too upsetting for them. I mean, they wouldn't think that it's upsetting, but it is. But Near Dark, of course, they like it because it's the action in it is bloody and there's jokes and it's a bit more humorous, and they kind of, you know, lean towards that now. They've grown up on movies like that, action with jokes and you can go and butcher somebody, and it's kind of a fun, enjoyable experience. They've seen plenty of movies like that. It appeals to them more. But at the same time, there's still been a little bit of a shock factor. It's not as slick as movies that they see now. But there's a kind of grittiness to it, a more realistic feel than movies that they've, you know, that they watch now.
What are some of the other ones that you teach in the classroom?
I try to teach at least one or two different films a semester. And I always have a zombie unit at the end of the semester. Like 3 or 4 weeks with the zombie stuff. And I've learned that I have to do Night of the Living Dead. There's no way around doing zombies without doing Night of the Living Dead. I've tried to do it without it, and you wind up, everything you say is like, but this really all comes in Night of the Living Dead. And I also do I Am Legend, actually, the Matheson novel, which inspires all that. I also like to teach Frankenstein a lot, and I always do the Karloff, you know, the James Whale Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein. And I try to throw in a movie I've never taught before. Like I taught Martin for the first time last year, so I got to do that. And I'm going to teach The Exorcist this semester coming up. And teaching The Exorcist in a Catholic college, I think, might be an interesting experience too. So, and I'm just dreading having it on in the classroom for some of those scenes. And I know the teachers down the hall can hear this blasting out of my classroom. So I'm interested to see what will happen, because I think The Exorcist is still shocking in a way. You know, this 12-year-old girl, you know, what she goes through in that bed and what she puts herself through and what she says is just, it is not something you usually see in movies. So I'm interested to do that this semester and see how my students react and see if I get reported.
Your mother so sucks in hell?
Is that the TV version?
I believe so. We'll be back after we play a preview for next week's show.
Hidden beneath the world we know is the world they inhabit.
Dave?
Yeah, Ma?
What are you doing?
I'm taking over a TV network.
I'll finish up, honey, and get to sleep.
They're hackers.
Hackers penetrate and ravage private and publicly owned computer systems.
Hack the planet!
Hack the planet!
It's not just something they do.
Sure, this sweet machine's not going to waste.
Are you challenging me?
It's who they are.
I win, you wear a dress on our date.
And if I win, so do you.
They can crack any code. Get inside any system.
Hello?
Mr. Gill, according to our records, you're dead.
What?
But this time...
Come here, look at this.
It's some kind of virus.
Unless $5 million is transferred to the following account, I will capsize 5 oil tankers.
They just hacked the wrong guy.
Game's over.
Whoever wrote this needs somebody to take the fall.
He's about to commit the perfect computer crime.
You've created a virus that's gonna cause a worldwide disaster?
And they're about to take the blame.
A hacker planted the virus. But it's the perfect cover.
Don't move!
We're being framed. Can we be allies? I don't play well with others.
Oh, wow, we are fried.
Okay, let's nail it. You're not good enough to beat me.
Yeah, maybe I'm not.
But we are.
They're the only ones who can prevent a catastrophe.
I know how to stop this guy.
They'll trace you like that.
Are you nuts? Come at me!
Unlike any the world has ever seen.
Never send a boy to do a woman's job.
Hackers of the world unite.
Cops on the building.
I need more time.
This is the end, my friend.
United Artists welcomes you to the new world. Yeah.
That's right. We'll be back next week with an episode all about hackers. I hope you'll be back to listen for that. I know that Rob's probably going to give it to me next week after kind of dumping on Near Dark.
I've got to fire back with both hands on hackers after you tore giant holes in Near Dark.
Yeah, well. So until we come back, we want to thank you for listening. We want to thank our special guests, Mike Mayo and Lance Henriksen. And hey, we want to thank you, Ed, for stopping by the show. But Ed, seriously, do you watch anything other than vampire films? Because that's pretty much the only thing we have you on for.
I watch a lot of horror, of course, you know, being the horror professor at LaSalle. But I watch all kinds of movies. And even weird, unusual movies that you guys like to talk about too. And you definitely, I think I said this last time, you need to do a Knight Riders show, and I would love to talk about Knight Riders. I'll see any movie, and it's funny. Actually, the older I get, the less I like to watch movies that don't have someone getting killed in them, shot or crime. I think the older I get, I am veering far more towards any kind of genre movie. I tend to rarely watch straight up dramas anymore. I don't know what that says about me, but
yeah, I think it was right after we did that Martin show, they announced the Blu-ray of Knight Riders coming out. So that's coming out like, I want to say November or something.
Yeah, I read the view of it. There's a nice documentary on it and all that. So I haven't seen it all yet. So I'm looking forward to that. And Shakespeare movies. Boy, I watch tons of Shakespeare. So, you know, there you go. And Jane Austen. I'll watch any Jane Austen thing.
You and Rob, yeah. Big Shakespeare fans.
Yeah, we have a couple of places we can plug you in 2014, and we'll definitely have to put Knight Riders on the list because that's one I haven't seen in a long time, and maybe I would appreciate it more now than I did when I saw it. So
the picture that I saw the other day on Facebook was like Tom Savini barely clothed laying on like a Knight Riders logo with these two busty girls behind them, and I was like, wow.
That's
okay.
Part of the storyline. Yeah. That's
all right.
Yeah, that's actually part of the storyline. So,
yeah,
he's very good in it too, Tom Savini. I think it's probably his best role as an actor.
Yeah, I mean, as we talked about him, Martin, he's great in these films with George Romero. But the thing I always remember about Knight Riders is it was sort of this mashup of a Renaissance festival with like a biker gang.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
There you go. Well, all right, Ed, thanks for coming on, and thanks to everyone for listening. And if you want to return the favor, you can head over to iTunes and make sure to drop us a review and, you know, maybe 5 stars, say. You know, it doesn't cost you anything. It's easy. And you know what? It's just the right thing to do. Don't you think so, Mr. Mike?
I totally think so. You know, before we get out of here, we should probably make the announcement that our VHS extravaganza was such a hit, our 4 freaking hour show all about VHS, that we are doing the son of the return of the revenge of VHS. I think it'll be the revenge of VHS. And that will be coming out sometime right after this show, I imagine, or maybe one more. We need a little bit of time to collect more people's thoughts. There were some stragglers, so let's get other people to call in here at 734-666-0800. Leave us your VHS memories, and we will play them on the air. Hold me tight, fever.
tried to kill him. She said, Daddy, oh, don't you dare, he gives me fever. When he kisses me, fever, when he holds me tight, fever. I'm his missus, so Daddy, oh, treat him right. Everybody's got fever, it's something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. A fever started long ago. He said, oh, Julie, baby, you're to blame. You give me fever. When the kisses, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever. But what a lovely way to burn. 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 What a lovely way to burn.
What you people want?
Just a couple more minutes of your time, about the same duration as the rest of your life.